Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, the UN Health and Labour Agencies said on Monday that safer working conditions are needed for health teams globally to combat the dangerous neglect they are facing. The World Health Organization, WHO, and the International Labour Organization, ILO, underscored that the pandemic had already taken an additional heavy toll on health workers. Even before the COVID-19 pandemic, the health sector was among the most hazardous sectors to work in, said WHO's Dr. Maria Nera. Although staff suffered from infections, physical disorders and injuries, workplace violence, harassment and burnout, she added that very few healthcare facilities had programs to manage their health and safety. A lack of safeguards for health workers contributed to the deaths of around 115,000 health workers who died from COVID-19 in the first 18 months of the pandemic. To combat this, WHO and ILO have released new health centre guidelines for implementation at national and local levels. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi has urged for greater protection for refugees and asylum seekers in Europe. He said in a statement on Monday that violence, ill-treatment and pushbacks continue to be regularly reported at multiple entry points at land and sea borders. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, expressed deep concern over an increasing number of incidents of violence and serious human rights violations against refugees and migrants at various European borders, several of which have resulted in tragic deaths. Despite repeated calls by UNHCR, other UN agencies, intergovernmental organizations and NGOs, the violence continues within and beyond the European Union. The statement continued. Mr. Grandi said that we are alarmed by recurrent and consistent reports coming from Greece's land and sea borders with Turkey, where UNHCR has recorded almost 540 reported incidents of informal returns by Greece since the beginning of 2020. Turkey currently hosts some 3.7 million Syrians and around 330,000 others, the majority of whom are Afghans. Disturbing incidents were also reported in Central and Southeastern Europe and the borders with EU member states. According to UNHCR, people are being pushed back and suffering a disturbing pattern of threats, intimidation, violence and humiliation. To India now, where UN-appointed independent rights experts called for an end to a malicious online campaign against an investigative journalist. The appeal from Special Rapporteurs Irene Khan and Mary Lawler follows what they've called relentless misogynistic and sectarian attacks against Rana Ayub, including death and rape threats. The journalist and women's rights defender is being targeted by far-right Hindu nationalist groups after reporting on issues affecting minority Muslims in India, criticizing the government for its handling of the pandemic, and comments on recent hijab bans in some schools and colleges. In a statement, the special rapporteur said that the lack of condemnation and proper investigation by the government has only served to falsely legitimize the attacks and attackers and further endangered her safety. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. France has announced President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin have agreed in principle to a summit proposed by French President Emmanuel Macron as diplomatic tensions continue to escalate over Ukraine. However, the White House said the meeting will only go ahead if Russia does not invade Ukraine, and Moscow says there are not yet concrete plans for the talks. The agenda would be set by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov when they meet on Thursday. On Friday, President Biden offered one of his starkest warnings yet over a possible invasion of Ukraine.
In the coming days, we believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
And do you have any indication about whether President Putin has made a decision on whether to invade? Do you feel confident that he hasn't made that decision already?
As of this moment, I'm convinced he's made the decision.
This comes amidst intensified fighting in eastern Ukraine. Two Ukrainian soldiers were killed Saturday, and Russian-backed separatists ordered evacuations of civilians, a move Ukraine blasted as a provocation and part of a Russian plan to stage attacks in the region. Meanwhile, Russia has extended military drills in Belarus that were set to end Sunday. On Saturday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called on Western nations to take stronger action, urging them to impose sanctions immediately as he spoke at the Munich Security Conference.
To me, as the president of a country that has lost parts of its territory and thousands of people, at whose border 150,000 Russian soldiers, military equipment, and heavy weapons stand, the answer is obvious. The world security architecture is fragile. It needs renewal. The rules that the world agreed on 10 years ago do not apply any longer.
Outside the Munich conference, hundreds of peace activists rallied in protest. We'll have the latest on Ukraine after headlines with The Nation magazine's Katrina VandenHeuvel. California Governor Gavin Newsom has announced his state is moving to the next phase of the coronavirus pandemic and will now treat COVID-19 as an endemic disease.
What we're announcing here today is about turning a page, moving from this crisis mentality, moving from a reactive framework to a framework where we are more sentinel in our approach, that we stand firm and confident as we lean into the future, moving away from a reactive mindset and a crisis mindset to living with this virus.
Many states have recently relaxed or lifted public health restrictions after the worst of the winter's Omicron surge, though an average of more than 2,000 people are dying of COVID-19 each day across the United States. In Britain, the Queen, the 95-year-old Queen Elizabeth, has tested positive for COVID-19 and is experiencing mild cold-like symptoms. In Canada, police arrested some 200 people and towed away dozens of vehicles clearing the streets of Ottawa of the weeks-long so-called Freedom Convoy, the anti-government trucker-led protests which started as a demonstration against COVID mandates inspired similar actions in other cities and countries. Its organizers have been linked to far-right and neo-Nazi groups. The World Health Organization announced six African nations will receive technology needed to produce their own mRNA vaccines. The countries are Egypt, Kenya, Nigeria, Senegal, South Africa, and Tunisia. It's part of a WHO initiative to expand vaccine access and decrease dependency on wealthier nations.
More than 80% of the population of Africa is yet to receive a single dose. Much of this inequity has been driven by the fact that globally vaccine production is concentrated in a few mostly high-income countries. One of the most obvious lessons of the pandemic, therefore, is the urgent need to increase local production of vaccines, especially in low and middle-income countries.
In Somalia, at least 13 people were killed and 20 others wounded Saturday in the city of Beledweyne after a suicide bomber detonated explosives inside a restaurant where a number of local officials and politicians were eating. At least one of those killed was a candidate in a parliamentary election that's been delayed for months. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. Mali's military says 8 soldiers were killed, 4 remain missing, and 14 others were injured after clashes with armed groups near Mali's borders with Burkina Faso and Niger on Friday. An estimated 57 unidentified fighters were also killed. Meanwhile, witnesses say about 40 civilians were killed in the area during recent fighting between rival armed groups. On Friday, French President Emmanuel Macron said French troops would gradually withdraw from Mali over the next 6 months. Mali's military rulers have called on France to withdraw without delay. France deployed troops to its former colony in 2013 after Tuareg rebels and groups with ties to Al-Qaeda seized control of two-thirds of Mali's territory. Talks to restore the landmark Iran nuclear deal have entered their final stretch as officials from opposing sides have expressed cautious optimism a deal may be within reach. Iran's parliament has set conditions for signing on to a new deal, which include the lifting of certain sanctions and a guarantee signatories will not unilaterally abandon the agreement as the U.S. did under Trump in 2018. This is Iran's foreign minister.
I would like to emphasize here that we are ready to achieve a good deal at the earliest possible time if the other side makes the needed political decision.
In Olympic news, Alana Myers-Taylor has become the most decorated black athlete in Winter Olympics history. She won the bronze medal alongside Sylvia Hoffman in the two-woman bobsled Saturday in Beijing, the American athlete's fifth career medal. Taylor collected more medals than any other woman in Olympic bobsledding. She also won the silver medal in the monobob at the Beijing Games. The 37-year-old is now a four-time Olympian. On Sunday, she waved the flag for the United States in the Olympics closing ceremony. In France, a close ally of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein was found dead in his prison cell on Paris Saturday. Jean-Luc Brunel was reportedly found hanged. Brunel, a former modeling agent, was being held on charges involving the rape and sex trafficking of minor girls. He was arrested at Paris's Charles de Gaulle Airport in 2020. He frequently accompanied Epstein and was considered central to the French investigation into accusations against Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein died by suicide in a Manhattan jail in 2019. While awaiting trial. In Minneapolis, a judge has sentenced former police officer Kim Potter to 2 years in prison for the fatal shooting of Dante Wright during a minor traffic stop last April. Potter was convicted of manslaughter in December. The judge in the case said Potter made a tragic mistake when she shot Wright, a 20-year-old black man. Potter claims she meant to deploy her taser. Dante's mother, Katie Wright, spoke after the sentence was announced Friday.
Kim Potter murdered my son, and he died April 11th. Today, the justice system murdered him all over again. To sit there and watch, pouring my heart out in my victim impact statement that took so long to write, and I reread it over and over again, to not get a response out of the judge at all. But then when it came down to sentencing Kim Potter, she broke out in tears. So once again, we are standing here to say that we're very disappointed in the outcome. This is the problem with our justice system today. White women tears trumps justice.
Chicago officials have rejected the final permit for the highly contested General Iron metal shredding plant in the city's southeast side. The area is home to mostly black and brown residents. It's a major victory for local activists whose protests included a hunger strike last year that drew national attention to the issue. A coalition of environmental groups said, quote, our community is not a sacrifice zone. This decision can be a turning point for communities of color that have been hurt by environmental racism for decades, they said. A federal judge ruled civil lawsuits against Donald Trump over his role in inciting the January 6th Capitol insurrection can proceed. Judge Amit Mehta said Trump's speech to supporters on January 6th appeared to be, quote, a call for collective action and the essence of civil conspiracy, unquote. There have been two major losses in the Pacifica radio family. In Los Angeles, Spanish-language community radio programmer Fernando Velasquez has died at the age of 73. His career spanned more than four decades. He was a dedicated producer, programmer, mentor, and organizer at Pacifica station KPFK in Los Angeles, where he served for a time as news director. And in Washington, D.C., journalist, photographer, jazz critic, and poet Askia Muhammad has died at the age of 76. Muhammad was a longtime programmer and news director at Pacifica station WPFW. His column in The Washington Informer regularly appeared in black-owned newspapers around the United States. In 2018, Askia Muhammad published the autobiography of Charles 67X, a collection of personal stories, photos, and poems about his four decades spent covering African-American culture and politics. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you might think you're not smart enough to talk about Ukraine. Especially on U.S. foreign policy, corporate news media seem to suggest that any questions you have that fall outside of their framework are not just dumb, but traitorous. Not earnest, but dangerously naive. Peace? Diplomacy? The idea that the U.S. might have broken promises? Might have material and not moral interests? Oh, so you love Putin then. There is an interesting, relevant history to the state of tension between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine, but understanding it involves letting go of the storyline in which the U.S. equals benevolent democracy and Russia equals craven imperialism. We got some of that history from Bryce Green, who wrote about Ukraine recently for FAIR.org. We'll hear that conversation today. But first, a very quick look at some recent press. The Biden administration decision to freeze the assets of Afghanistan's central bank and maintain economic sanctions have sent the country's economy into a tailspin. As Julie Holler writes for FAIR.org, Biden announced his intention to take the $7 billion in frozen funds currently held in U.S. banks and use them as he likes, giving half to a humanitarian aid trust fund for Afghans and half to families of 9/11 victims. That $7 billion, most of which originated as international aid and represents the vast majority of the central bank's assets, belongs to the Afghan people, not Biden. And the Afghan people don't need to pay for the September 11th attacks. They've paid plenty in the form of the invasion and occupation of their country. Beyond that, giving them back half of the money that's rightfully theirs in the form of aid instead of returning it to the banking system not only doesn't solve the country's liquidity problem, it's nearly impossible to do given the sanctions still in place. Anyone who truly cares about the Afghan people, Holler writes, should be tearing their hair out about this injustice that's surely going to result in more deaths and hardship. But despite their wailing about the Taliban's impact on Afghan women's futures, few in U.S. TV news seem concerned about those same women facing starvation as a result of U.S. policy, as evidenced by the exactly zero reports aired by broadcast network news shows. CNN's newsroom reporter did note that there are questions about whether taking these funds away from the central bank could make it more difficult for Afghanistan to stabilize its currency. Serious Humane reporting would explain that those aren't questions, but certainties. A senior foreign policy aide told The Intercept's Austin Allman that Biden has had warnings from the UN Secretary General, the International Rescue Committee, and the Red Cross, with a unanimous consensus that the liquidity of the central bank is of paramount importance, and no amount of aid can compensate for the destruction of Afghanistan's financial system and the whole macro economy. Allman notes that the decision puts Biden on track to cause more death and destruction in Afghanistan than was caused by the 20 years of war that he ended. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Many Americans are confused or just unknowledgeable about Ukraine. They couldn't find it on a map. A 2014 Washington Post story noted that the less Americans know about Ukraine's location, the more they want the U.S. to intervene. Well, into that void have rushed corporate news media, telling us for weeks now that there is a threat, presumably to us, over there, and we need to get ready for war. The ease with which media step into saber-rattling mode, the confidence, as they soberly suggest people other than themselves might need to be sent off to a violent death in service of something they can only describe with vague platitudes, should be disturbing. U.S. officials accusing journalists who ask basic evidentiary questions of consorting with the enemy should be disturbing. The very fact that news media have a framework in which there are enemies whose actions don't merit thoughtful consideration, and a U.S. us whose actions are always good, all of this should disturb you, not just about foreign policy, but about the power of news media to amp people up to accept horrific, avoidable actions. The current crisis with the U.S. and Russia about Ukraine is a test of many things, not least news media's ability and willingness to disengage themselves from these frozen narratives, from uncritical parroting of official sources, and from the devastating idea that diplomacy is weakness and massive violence or threats of massive violence are the best way to address conflict. Bryce Green's piece, What You Should Really Know About Ukraine, appeared recently on fair.org. He joins us now by phone from Indianapolis. Welcome to Counterspin, Bryce Green.
Thanks for having me on. I'm happy to be here.
Well, your straightforward piece, an explainer about explainers, got more than 3,000 shares on fair.org. People needed it. And I'm just going to ask you to talk us through the official line on Ukraine and the questions that we should have about it. Because all of the elements, Russians as cartoons, the U.S. as ever engaged in democracy promotion, oh, are there material interests there? How dare you suggest? It's also dusty, this playbook, you know, and part of what feels so dated about it is that it's about NATO. I know for a fact that listeners under, like, heck, 40 years old are like, well, I've heard the word NATO, but what? You know, why? Isn't the Cold War over? And yet NATO and what it represents in 2022 are at the core here. So just start us off wherever you would like to in terms of helping people understand what's actually going on right now.
Right. So most media outlets try to put the current escalation in context. And when they do, they usually start at one event, the 2014 annexation of Crimea. And they use this to demonstrate how Russia has imperial ambitions to reconquer the old Soviet territories and reestablish the Soviet Union. But for that to have any real credibility, you need to ignore what happened right before 2014, what happened right before the Donbass uprising, what happened before Russia became backing the separatist rebels. And that takes you back to early 2014, when the U.S. government helped violently oust the president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, in what was called the Maidan coup. After he fled the country, the new government immediately established closer ties to Europe and the U.S. and turned away from Putin's Russia. Now, understanding why and how he did that is key to understanding Putin's actions today. Like, if the United States had a neighbor who was recently had a government change instigated in part by Russia, and then that country tried to join a hostile military alliance, I think the U.S. would be rightly concerned. They'd lose their minds. But you don't really see that same concern extended to what's going over there in Ukraine. So this whole story of NATO expansion and economic expansion, it begins right after the Cold War and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The U.S. and Russia made a deal that NATO, the Cold War alliance, you know, would not expand east past a reunified Germany. No reason to escalate tensions unnecessarily, but unfortunately, Washington decided to expand anyway. And, you know, they were the only superpower left. There was no one to challenge them, so they decided that they can do it. They ignored Russian objections and continued to englare the military alliance one country at a time. And even at the time, Cold Warriors, like the famed diplomat George Kennan, warned that this was a recipe for disaster. It would make Russia feel trapped and surrounded. And when major nuclear powers feel trapped and surrounded, that doesn't really make for a peaceful world. But as we all know, Washington isn't in the interest of peace, and they did it anyway. In 2004, the U.S. poured millions of dollars into the anti-Russian opposition in Ukraine. They funded media and NGOs supporting opposition candidates. And they did this using organizations like the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, and USAID, These organizations are broadly understood to serve regime change interests in the name of, quote-unquote, democracy. Now, in 2004, it didn't work exactly, but Ukraine began to start making closer ties to the EU and U.S., and that process continued up to 2014. Now, shortly before the overthrow, the Ukrainian government was negotiating closer integration into the EU and closer integration with the Western Economic Bloc, and they were being offered loans by the International Monetary Fund, the major world lending agency that represents private interests around the Western world. So to get those loans, they had to do all sorts of things to their economy, commonly known as structural adjustment. This included cutting public sector wages, shrinking the health and education sectors, and privatizing the economy, and cutting gas subsidies for the people. At the time, Russia was offering a plan for economic integration to Ukraine that didn't contain any of these strings. So when President Viktor Yanukovych chose Russia, well, that set off a wave of protests that were supported and partially funded by the United States. In fact, John McCain and Obama administration officials even flew to the Maidan Square to help support the protesters who wanted to oust the president and change the government. So at this point, I want listeners to ask themselves, like, what if Russia were sending high-level government officials to anti-government protests in Canada or Mexico? Like, what if one of Putin's advisors right now went to go encourage the trucker protests in Canada and said that they should get rid of their current government? We'd lose our minds, and rightfully so. That stuff's ridiculous. And what's worse is that right after the protests started, there was a leaked phone call between Victoria Nuland, one of Obama's State Department advisors, and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, in which they were describing how they wanted to set up a new government. They were picking and choosing who would be in the government, who would be out. Well, a few weeks after that, the Ukrainian government was overthrown, and the guy who they designated as, you know, our guy, Yatsenyuk, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, he became the prime minister. So clearly there's a lot of U.S. involvement in how the Ukrainian government has shifted over the last decade. After 2014, the Ukrainians, they opted to accept the IMF loans. They opted to further integrate with the EU economically. And Russia is watching all of this happen. And so immediately after the overthrow, the eastern regions in Ukraine, who were ethnically closer to Russians and they speak Russian and they favor closer ties to Russia, they revolted. They started an uprising to gain more autonomy, possibly to separate from the Ukraine entirely. The Ukrainian government cracked down hard, and that only fueled the rebellion. And so Russia sent in volunteers and soldiers to help back these rebels. Now, of course, Russia denies it, but we all know they are. And so since 2014, that sort of civil war has been at a stalemate. And every so often there would be military exercise on the border by one side or another, but really nothing much has changed. And so this current escalation, it was started because of the U.S. involvement in the Ukrainian government's politics.
Right.
And when Russia started building up troops on the border, the United States started saying, hey, they're about to attack. Of course, they didn't have any evidence for that. The Russians had built up troops on the border at similar numbers in the past without the similar panic.
Right.
But this time, there was a lot of panic. So at this point, the U.S. media starts saying that, yes, this is Russia. They're building up to invade Ukraine. They're similar to Hitler or some other dictator that's violating national sovereignty. And so now you have the U.S. sending millions and millions and millions of dollars in weapons. They're claiming that an invasion is imminent. There was this strange thing from the State Department about the Russians planning a false flag attack to justify an invasion. Of course, the State Department didn't provide any evidence for that.
And in fact, a reporter, you know, Matt Lee of AP pushed back on that, right? Famously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a normal person should. But then Ned Price, the State Department spokesperson, he accused them of being pro-Russia or consorting with the enemy. It was really ridiculous. But those are the roots of this entire escalation, this situation, these heightened tensions. And all of that is completely omitted from the Western media. How can you talk about the current situation without talking about the past? How can you understand Russia's actions without understanding how the United States might have provoked them? And yet you have pundits all over the place asking, what does Putin want? Who knows if Putin's going to invade? Or on another end is like, Putin won't stop with Ukraine. He'll keep going. His goal is to reestablish the Soviet Union or the Russian Empire. And this is all ridiculous. From the start, Putin has been clear that he does not want NATO to expand, that he does not want missiles stationed just across his border. He doesn't want troops there. He doesn't want those problems on his border. But that doesn't seem to be something that the United States media can understand. In fact, when Putin sent a proposal to Biden talking about NATO, talking about the weapons, talking about the missiles, the media described these as non-starters, mm-hmm. as if asking for missiles not to be pointed at you at point-blank range is out of the question to ask. Putin should accept that there will be a bunch of missiles, that there will be a bunch of soldiers and things and military bases all pointed at him. And that doesn't square. Like, imagine, again, if the U.S. were being asked to tolerate missiles pointed at us in Mexico or Canada. Again, we would go crazy.
Well, U.S. exceptionalism is part of the price of admission to serious news media conversation. You're supposed to accept that the United States has the right to intervene anywhere, anytime. You know, if we're going to talk about who owes who what, or the U.S., James Baker made a commitment about NATO and its reach, and somehow that's also off the page.
Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes discussed in media. Like, there was a Washington Post article, and they interviewed Mary Cerotti, and she wrote one of the major books talking about this promise not to expand to the East. And she said straight up, Washington got greedy, and that destabilized the region. And that was just one interview in, you know, a sea of the official line, in a sea of opinions and articles talking about how Vladimir Putin wants to expand the Soviet empire. Like, just having one article in the midst of all the noise, it doesn't really do much to cut through. So it is admitted by the media, but it isn't really addressed. They don't take it into account when they do their analyses. And that reflects a major American exceptionalist bias.
Well, let me just say, polls, despite the media onslaught, despite corporate media slipping so easily into saber-rattling mode, it's just so unsettling to see the ease with which news media go back into, yeah, them, they're horrible, yes, us, we're great, and surely killing is the answer. Despite all of that, and despite disinformation, polls are still showing that people in the U.S. don't want a war with Russia. Apparently, Russian polls show that Russian people don't want a war. People understand the harms of these things that pundits are blithely tossing about. And so I just want to ask you, like, there are other voices. There are other ideas about how to go forward. Can you just talk about, like, other avenues, what diplomacy might look like, what media that take diplomacy seriously might look like or might include or exclude?
Part of the stalemate between the Eastern Donbass rebels and the Ukrainian government, part of that was started because they agreed to a ceasefire in something called the Minsk II agreement.
Right.
The Minsk agreements were... It was an arrangement where the Ukraine would provide a degree of autonomy to the Donbas region, and Russia would withdraw all of its volunteers and troops. The area would be sort of demilitarized, and then there would be elections in that region and some sort of special status for that region afterwards. Well, Ukraine has refused to implement it, and Washington and the rest of the European Union, they don't really push Ukraine on this. There are a lot of reasons for that. Mainly, one of them is because that they don't think that they would be able to join NATO if they had a region of their country that isn't fully controlled by the country. And so there's been sort of a stagnation there. But there's been a lot of people, analysts, who are talking about restarting these Minsk II agreements, talking about how can we get to a point where we're talking about it again and implementing it and maybe reimagining it for a more recent time, a more modern time. But those voices are very rarely included in the mainstream media. Like, people talk about negotiations, and then they talk about all the quote-unquote non-starters that Putin's offering, but they don't talk about the framework for diplomacy that already exists. One of the best commentators on this is Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Mm-hmm. He writes very clearly. He had a very good article in The Nation about the Minsk II agreements. And there are some in the media who do take his voice and amplify it. He was on Mehdi Hassan's show on MSNBC. He's one of the only decent people on MSNBC.
Right.
And then I think he was interviewed once on NPR. But beyond that, no one hears about that. No one hears that there is a diplomatic solution that can apply to the situation. And so the result is that people are scared that, okay, there's going to be a war. And the only off-ramp seems to be non-starters. So it's very surprising.
And it's disheartening in the sense that people who, I'm talking about U.S. citizens, they really don't, they don't have a beef with Ukraine. They don't know what's going on in Ukraine. They are only looking at news media for their cues
mm-hmm.
of what to understand and how to feel. And we didn't even get started on if you learned more about Ukrainian movements and what they're about, would those be the team that you would back? You know, that's
right,
a whole
right.
other story, yeah?
Yeah. So part of the opposition that helped topple the government in 2014 were made up of the far right. And I don't know, we in America throw around the term Nazi. Sometimes it applies, sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Here, in this case, it absolutely applies. These are open Nazis flying Nazi symbols, Nazi flags, doing Nazi salutes, and they have an ethnic purity idea about why they're opposed to Russia. And so the United States utilized these people to help overthrow the government. There was a lot of violence around the time of the overthrow. Some of these Nazis, they actually gathered a bunch of protesters in a building, locked the doors, and set the building on fire, killing dozens. But none of this is talked about when we talk about the current situation. And part of those far-right groups, part of those far-right militias, they were integrated into the Ukrainian military, the Ukrainian National Guard. And this is the same National Guard that the U.S. has given about $2.5 billion. And we don't talk about it. You know, Congress did have a provision that restricted aid to this specific sector of the Ukrainian military. But there was a report from, I think, the Daily Beast that said that there really is no mechanism for enforcing that. Like, it's on paper, but it's not in practice. And so the United States is actively funding Nazi militias. That's just a fact. And in fact, recently, there was a picture of an old woman holding an AK-47 in a training session. And it was used in Western media to show that the Ukrainian people are ready to defend their homeland. Well, people did some digging on the ground, and it turns out that this was a public relations event staged by these Nazis, by the Azov Battalion. But no one reported that in Western media. In fact, I think it was Richard Engel of NBC, I believe. He tweeted a picture out it. People called him out and said, hey, these are Nazi people. There was actually a Nazi patch visible in the footage that was used on TV. No accountability.
No
accountability. No one is forced to say, oops, sorry, I didn't mean to spread Nazi propaganda to Western audiences.
Right.
No one is saying that. But that's U.S. media for you. You see it in Czech press, in Irish press, and all over the world. They're like, yeah, these were straight-up Nazis. This was a Nazi event. And the U.S. media can't seem to grasp this.
I'll just finish up where we started, because I know that listeners are uninformed and almost ashamed of being uninformed about what's going on, as often the case in foreign policy. And then they are reliant on U.S. media to tell them which side they're on and to explain the interests. And just in the final, you know, minute or so, somebody's picking up a paper, looking at Ukraine. What are some questions that you would just say, keep this in your mind as you read this coverage, because it's not done. It's not done. You know, we're still, it's going forward. What should we keep in mind as we look at media coverage going forward from today?
One of the biggest questions that I ask myself whenever I'm reading a piece like this, aside from taking history into account, which is important, but you should also ask yourself, who are the sources being utilized in this story? Very often you'll see a story that says, according to U.S. intelligence, or according to this State Department official, or according to someone in the government, like official sources. Well, if you look at the history of U.S. media and U.S. government public relations, there's a well-documented and very extensive history of government lying to the public. The classic example, WMD.
Yep.
WMD, for many people, destroyed the credibility of the media because they credibly took government statements at face value. They didn't question them. They didn't seek out alternative explanations. They didn't challenge the government when they said what they said. And so that's sort of what they're doing here. Repeatedly, you're seeing stories about intelligence officials who say that an invasion is imminent without providing any evidence. And so you have to take intelligence and official government sources with a grain of salt. When an intelligence agency says that Russia is going to invade, well, the only information you have is that an intelligence agency wants you to believe that Russians are going to invade, regardless of whether or not they are going to. And so that's one filter that might help cut through the noise when reading the media.
We've been speaking with Bryce Green. Bryce Green's piece, What You Should Really Know About Ukraine, appeared recently on fair.org. Bryce Green, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
We begin today's show in Honduras, where authorities have arrested former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who faces extradition to the United States on drug trafficking charges. Hernandez was a longtime U.S. ally who'd led Honduras from 2014 until this past January 27th, when he was succeeded by Xiomara Castro, Honduras's first female president. This week's dramatic events began Monday when the U.S. State Department formally requested the extradition of the former president, alleging he smuggled over 1 million pounds of cocaine into the United States since 2004. On Tuesday, over 100 Honduran police officers surrounded his home, then took him into custody. Fireworks exploded in Tegucigalpa as video emerged showing Juan Orlando Hernandez being escorted from his home in a bulletproof vest with his wrists and ankles in chains. The extradition case now heads to Honduras' Supreme Court. Last year, a federal court in New York sentenced his brother, Tony Hernandez, to life in prison for drug trafficking. Juan Orlando Hernandez was listed as an unindicted co-conspirator in another drug smuggling case. To talk more about the arrest of former President Juan Orlando Hernandez, we're joined by two guests. Dana Frank is professor of history emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. And joining us from Honduras is Gerardo Torres Zelaya, Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs of Honduras in Xiomara Castro's new administration. He's joining us, actually, from France. Welcome to Democracy Now! Both. It's great to have you with us. Gerardo Torres Zelaya, let's begin with you. Can you talk about the significance of the arrest of the not just former president of Honduras, a U.S.-backed president of Honduras, but he just stepped down from office?
Hello, Amy, Juan, and Dana. It's a pleasure. Thank you for this invitation. Hello to everyone that watches Democracy Now! In the United States and all around the world. Well, February 15 will stay forever in the history of Honduras. Juan Orlando Hernandez is the first former president of my country that has been ever arrested for drug trafficking. 2 years ago, I was also here at the European Parliament as member of the resistance, as member of the Liberal Party. And when we said that we were fighting and struggling against a dictatorship, a drug cartel, a trafficking state, a criminal state in Honduras, and we were fighting as a peaceful movement, and we were trying to bring a political change to Honduras, many people here in the European Parliament told us that we were exaggerating, that we couldn't use those kinds of adjectives to speak to a government that for Europe was also, as for the United States, an important ally in the region. But as Hondurans, we knew what was going on in our country. When the South District of New York condemned President Hernandez's brother, Tony Hernandez, as you just said, we knew that it was a step in the correct direction. The United States, because of their support after to the governments that came after the coup d'etat, also allowed them to gain very strong power in the region. And that power, they use it for criminal activities and for drug trafficking. Hernandez had impunity. Hernandez wasn't going to be sent to jail as long as he or his party will continue in power. But on November 28th of last year, the Honduran people gave a very strong message. We have been participating since 2013, 2017, and in 2021, the difference that we had was over 20% of the vote, and that enabled them to try any strategies that had to do with fraud or violence that we have seen in the country in years before. In 2021, the people of Honduras went hopefully to vote. We had the biggest voting in our history. We have the first women to become president in their country, and them losing power, the national party that had became this strong party after the coup d'etat 2009, lost control of the Honduran government. And once they lost control of the Honduran government, then all these actions that have been already been worked or built in the United States, especially in the South District of New York, it started to took place. We received a letter two days ago from the United States asking for the extradition of Juan Orlando Hernandez, former president of Honduras. We sent that request to our Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court acted immediately. And also the Attorney General's office, the police, and in less than 24 hours, who was a couple of months ago the strongest man in Honduras and one of the strongest men in Central America, was arrested because of his participation in Central America's biggest and strongest drug cartel that was able to become so strong because of the impunity that came by because of the political interest to maintain the government that took power after the coup d'etat of 2009. So we as Honduran people, we're hopeful. We're not happy because it's not easy to say to the world what we have become, but it's hopeful and it brings a lot of opportunities to see that this new government with Xiomara Castro at the head of government has less than 20 days in office, and we have already given strong messages and strong actions that things in my country are starting to change.
And Vice Minister Torres, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the, were you surprised by the change of direction of the U.S. government here? Because after all, this request for extradition must have received approval from the White House, and President Biden was part of the administration of Barack Obama back then. When Juan Orlando Hernandez was, before becoming president, he was also president of the National Congress back in 2010 when Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration pointed to the Congress as the reason why they were not opposing the coup against President Zelaya. They said that this was a battle between two branches of government. But now we're finding out that, as you say, that there was a narco state, not only the Hernandez brothers, both of whom were in the Congress, but also the chief of the National Police, Juan Carlos Bonilla, was also indicted as a drug trafficker. So you, in essence, had the Clinton and, I mean, the Clinton and Barack Obama were backing a Congress that was dominated back then by our narco traffickers. Have you been surprised by the change of direction now of the Biden administration?
Well, as you well say and remember, the coup d'etat against President Manuel Zelaya took place only 6 months after President Obama started power in the United States. For those 8 years that he was in office, we had a lot of visits to the United States to alert what was going on in our country, to tell the United States and the international community what was going on in Honduras. We were living in a narco state. We had many people that were part of the political movements that were killed, tortured, imprisoned. And it was really hard for us to go. I had the opportunity, I think 10 years ago, to be the first time with Amy in this show and talking about exactly the same things that we're saying today. Democracy Now! Always gave us that opportunity to say what was really going on in Honduras. But we didn't have that much attention when we went to the United States Senate or the United States government. And they said, as you just said, that it was a political problem. And we told them it wasn't just a political problem. We were presenting a political solution to something that went that went farther away than democracy. It didn't have to do just with elections. It had to do with a dictatorship, a military dictatorship that had whole power, that had kidnapped democracy, and that was refusing to give the Honduran people the rights that other countries or other people had. We didn't have the possibility to participate. This became dangerous, the most dangerous country to be a journalist, to be a woman, to be an environmentalist, to be a lawyer. Honduras became the world's most violent country. And when we were to the Obama administration and told them that it was because we had a dictatorship, that this wasn't a political competition, that this was people organizing to fight against this narco state, against these criminal organizations, they told us that we were exaggerating. Then we had the change in government in the United States, and in Trump administration, pay even less attention to our claims. Migration became bigger. People in Honduras were escaping this reality that we were living. And then I have to say, with Mr. Biden and Kamala Harris coming in office, we saw a shift in the United States position towards Honduras. And maybe it had to do because the narco state had went out of hand, or maybe because they really had a desire to stop this criminal organization to continue in the control of the Honduran government and in the control of our state. We saw a difference in this administration. We also saw that the DEA in the South District of New York started to make actions against the National Party. In Honduras, they had the control of Congress, of the presidency, and the Supreme Court. It was impossible for anyone to hope for any investigation in the Hernandez brothers or the members of the National Party or the government. But the participation of the DEA in the South District of New York allowed that impunity started to weaken. And these people that had never shown any way of responsibility in front of law were starting to be being called and asked to respond for their actions. And now we had also the support from the Biden-Harris administration in this past elections of November of 2021. And we had the participation of the United States Vice President. It was the first time in Honduras that happened. And we know that it's not very common that happens in Latin America. Vice President Kamala Harris was with President Xiomara Castro in her inauguration. And I think that was a clear message that things were changing in the relationship that the United States has had with Honduras in the last 12 years. The first action that they did a week ago was to suspend or cancel the visa of Juan Orlando Hernández. And we knew that that was the first step in the United States to start a legal action against Hernández, who's being charged of drug trafficking, weapon trafficking, and the conspiracy to assassinate public officers in Honduras, attorneys, lawyers, and many people that in my country were killed to speak out and to talk about what was really going on in the country in moments when it was very dangerous, in moments where, unfortunately, not many people were paying attention. Now the world has paid attention. This is a message that I have given here in the European Union. What we said 2 years ago, now you have proof. We weren't exaggerating. We defeated not a political party. We defeated a criminal organization, and we defeated, with democracy and political participation, a narco state. And now we're trying to bring democracy back to Honduras.
Well, I'd like to bring in Dana Frank to the conversation. Professor Frank, were you surprised by this latest action? You've written that Juan Orlando Hernández is guilty of much more than just a drug trafficking. If you could talk about his legacy and about the sudden decision a few weeks ago announcement by Secretary of State Blinken that Juan Orlando Hernández was on something called the Engel list. Could you explain what the Engel list is?
Yeah, well, first of all, Juan Orlando Hernández is not just a drug trafficker. He's a dictator that has controlled the Supreme Court, the Attorney General, the military and police, and the Congress for 8 years, and has wrought incredible disruption on the Honduran people with tremendous repression and militarization. So the U.S. wants to talk about this as just drug trafficking or corruption, and it's much more than that. It's a destruction of the state and massive thievery and repression. So just to frame all that, you know, and, you know, in terms of the Engel list, you know, what happened was that there is this list that State Department was forced to come put out with saying which the people who have committed crimes or are corrupt. And when they put out the list last July, they only put some few people on it that were like nobodies and were already in procedures, criminal procedures. And they left off Juan Orlando and other top people in his administration very deliberately. A week ago, they announced that they had, in fact, secretly put Hernández on the list last July. Now, they did that because of Senator Merkley and Congresswoman Schakowsky and dozens of other Congress members and senators who had called for sanctions on Juan Orlando. And so what I think was going on is the State Department decided that they had to allow the Southern District of New York to charge Juan Orlando and ask for his extradition. They couldn't stop that any longer, claiming there was a precedent that you couldn't charge a president. And so I think the State Department wanted to look good and look like they were heroic. When they actually did it last year, didn't tell anybody. So they want to look like they were part of this all along. And, you know, well, of course, why didn't they tell anyone last July if they did it? And they did it kicking, screaming all the way. In fact, the Biden administration has supported Juan Orlando for 8 years. Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations have supported Juan Orlando for 8 years with military spending and intelligence sharing, support of the police, all the way up to the day that Xiomara Castro took power on January 27th. And in fact, the Biden administration did not want the Southern District of New York to charge Juan Orlando. They were never happy that his brother was charged and convicted of drug trafficking and sent to jail for life. And, you know, so it's not like the Biden administration is the heroic figure here. They are kicking and screaming all the way and then now trying to look like they're anti-corruption when they actually created and supported this monster, Juan Orlando Hernández, and the whole post-coup regime. So it's really important to see that they created this monster. Now they're kicking him out because it's no longer convenient for them for geostrategic reasons, for all kinds of reasons. They've chosen to recognize Xiomara Castro and quote-unquote support her, which is, of course, a dubious concept anyway because the leopard isn't going to change its spots, and they're still going to try to control her and make Honduras safe for transnational corporations and the U.S. military.
We're going to link to Juan's questioning of Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State running for president when he was working at the New York Daily News editorial board, asking her about why the U.S. supported the coup against the current president, Xiomara's husband, President Zelaya. It's very interesting. But before you both go, Gerardo Torres Zelaya, I wanted to ask you about where you are right now. You're in Paris, but you're coming from the refugee camps in Algeria of the Sahrawi. Honduras has long supported the Sahrawi government in exile, as over 80 countries have. Juan Orlando Hernandez started to side with Morocco. But can you talk about the significance of your trip?
Well, yes. I'm currently at France in Strasbourg in the European Parliament offices. As I said, we just started in government, and well, my visit here is to know better how the Honduran state is represented in the multilateral United Nations offices here in Europe. I'm going.
That was the foreign minister of Honduras in Paris being interviewed about the drug bust. We'll join John Grant here on his thoughts. You know, John has traveled to Honduras several times. John Grant.
Hey. How you doing?
So, all right. Mm-hmm. So, who was this guy they busted? I mean, that was today's Democracy Now!, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Okay. His name is the former president. He's Hernandez. Juan Orlando Hernandez. Arrived at his extradition hearing in Tegucigalpa on last week, I guess it was, or a week before, in handcuffs and shackles, and the U.S. is seeking to extradite him to the United States for drug trafficking charges. And also, his brother is now convicted and doing life in prison in the United States for the same crime. So, just to people up to speed here on the Orlando Hernandez family here. And, of course, Xiomara Castro is now the president. She is the wife of Manuel Zelaya, who, of course, was thrown out in 2009 by a point of a gun in his pajamas and flown out of the country. Duly elected president in a coup, not unlike 1954 Guatemala, which, of course, is famous. And, of course, as we all know and we've complained about many, many, many times, President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton did nothing against that coup and basically accepted the coup government and, you know, tried to facilitate all the, you know, fluffing it up in their eyes as they could, and of course turned Honduras into, you know, a charnel house with, you know, open season on murdering people who might be on the opposition, and it allowed in, you know, lots of the U.S. and Obama sent in lots of, you know, drug troops in these little units that were stationed throughout Honduras. And, you know, obviously the president of the goddamn country is running, you know, or making money off the drug business. He's working against the so-called drug war, U.S. drug war. And, you know, here we are. We, you know, the coup ushered in one of the more corrupt governments and murder regimes of Honduran history. So here we are, you know. And thank you, President Obama. You know, It wasn't his finest hour. But it's good that Xiomara Castro is now the president, and it's good that, they arrest this SOB president. I don't care if he's the drug war is ridiculous, but the point is he's corrupt, and if they have to use drug wars to get laws to get him, hey, that's fine. It's a mess, you know. Central America is a mess. It's been a mess for decades. Anyway.
Could you tell us about that? You were telling me in the green room about that. You and Luann flying in or flying out of that town?
Well, I was deported from Honduras in 1986, I guess. Or no, it was 1984. What am I saying?
Hello?
A trip. Yeah. Hello?
Yeah, so I thought you said there was an airplane crash.
Well, it's a complicated story. That's another. We were scheduled, my wife and I were scheduled to go afterwards, after I was deported, I think a couple years later in 1986, we were going to go down to a conference in Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras. Well, we were at the Miami airport scheduled to be on a Tansasa, which is a Honduran airline, plane to Tegucigalpa, when suddenly there's this big hush-hush and secrecy and sit down, the plane's not here, we have problems. And, I went up and finally after an hour and a half or so, I went up and said, what the fuck is going on here? And the guy said, well, we don't want to tell anybody, but the plane you're supposed to be on crashed arriving in Tegucigalpa, so it never left Tegucigalpa to come to Miami. the whole plane was killed. And landing in Tegucigalpa is a rather, nail-chewing event because, you cruise around the city, which is very hilly, lots of hills in Tegucigalpa. And so the airport is basically like landing in a teacup that the plane has to circle and come down into the teacup and then land at the bottom. So this one didn't land right. It crashed. Anyway, so that was a little sidebar story about my wife and I. But anyway, we finally, to make the story end and, the absurdity of it all, we finally got there. They got us on a Salvadoran plane. They put us up in San Salvador over the night, and then we got a plane in the morning to Tegucigalpa. And, of course, as fate would have it, they had a record of my deportation, and I was down there with the perverts and drug and criminals and whatnot, and they wouldn't let me in. So I started to, be a big man on campus and argue with the guy, and the guy spoke English. He said, listen, pal, the plane is waiting for you on tarmac, and, if you don't get on that plane, you're going to jail in Tegucigalpa. Imagine that. Do you want to do that? And I said, good point, sir. I take your point, senor, and landed I got on the plane and came back. Well, they didn't charge us for that trip. They just put us on us and dropped us off in Miami. And so we still technically had the back end, two tickets on the back end of that trip, round trip from Tegucigalpa, because they didn't charge us for that. They just wanted to get the fuck rid of us, And so we then maneuvered that. I finagled that into a round trip ticket for Luann, and Luann then went back to Tegucigalpa, flew back, and attended this conference, and had all sorts of adventures there. Because, frankly, Luann had only traveled once to Central America, and so she came back, and it was a whole saga, anyway. So I was a persona non grata in Honduras. I was, get the fuck out because you were deported for a political act in 1984, where six of us appeared in Tegucigalpa at a you know, there were like 3,000 people in the square. And we spoke about we didn't like the U.S. occupation of Honduras and use of Honduras in the Contra War. And so the military went in and cut off a radio feed for our speeches. And then they basically arrested us later.
Oops, I think we might have lost you, John. John, we may have lost him. I don't know what's going on there. He may not know. We'll put on a little music and get back with you, listeners. Sorry about that. Okay, listeners, we got him back. We got John Grant back on the line. I don't know exactly what happened there, but
it's a mystery.
We lost you in the middle of the
my Honduran saga. There, okay, yeah.
To the ditch. You've taught all of us and me and the.
Oh well, yes, of course, Honduras. If you look up the word Honduras in the Spanish English dictionary, you will find that it is refers to as depth, or in some cases a ditch, and the example they use meterse en Honduras, which means beyond one's depth, over one's head, you know, up to the neck in shit, basically.
Yeah.
You know, the example of what they use. So you know, Spanish conquistador traveling through Central America came to, you know, Honduras and Tegucigalpa area, and the best they could do was describe it as the depth or a ditch. You know, it's like, it doesn't, I don't know. Poor Honduras, I really feel for the place.
Yeah, right. Well, I know I didn't get you hooked up on the phone soon enough to listen to that full interview, but this guy that was, I guess he's a foreign minister for the...
Okay.
He was saying incredible things like, you know, it wasn't just the drugs. I mean, this former
Hernandez.
President had a...
Yeah.
And his brother, they had like a stranglehold on many parts of the government and the population as a whole. Everybody knew that. Everybody knew it. And
well, that again, they couldn't again, get rid of it. Again, thanks to the coup, Dawn Hours in 2009, when this element that, you know, that foisted Hernandez on Honduras so that he could become the typical strongman and control everything for the wealthy and the powerful and the thuggery and the gangsters and all that stuff, you know, the United States accepted that coup. It didn't say, whoa, foul, stop. Go to the UN and say, you know, we insist that this guy step down and, you know, that the duly elected president of Honduras be allowed into the country. They did not do that. They did the standard crap that the United States has always done vis-a-vis Central America and said, okay, well, you know what, we can't do anything about it. In fact, it benefits our wealthy, powerful people at home here, as it usually does, all these coups that we've overseen in Latin America. So business as usual, you know, most Americans don't give a flying rat's ass about it anyway. You know, they just, you know, keep my life comfortable and cushy and everything will be fine. You can do what you want in a place like Honduras. I don't care. And, of course, Barack Obama is a smart guy. He knew that. Hillary Clinton knew that. And so they snuggled up with the winners and the powers, and look what happened to Honduras. You know, the murder rate went sky high. You know, they were killing peasants and activists and labor organizers and things like that like crazy. That's the reason that six of us went to Tegucigalpa in 1984, because they were disappearing labor people and poor people and activists and whatnot. You know, we had a meeting then, you know, not only so, did we, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah, please go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to ask you, so do you think, because the same, the foreign minister also said,
mm-hmm.
it seemed to be a, they knew there seemed to be a turning point
mm-hmm.
when this lady got elected and,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and Vice President Kamala Harris attended her inauguration.
Exactly.
The,
right.
the people mm-hmm. in the country, it,
right.
it seemed to be sending a message that something was changing. Now,
absolutely.
I think this guy's brother was busted
mm-hmm.
before that.
As I say, Hernandez, I forget his name, I don't have it in front of me, but Hernandez, the ex-president, his brother is currently doing life in prison in the United States. So he was convicted
right.
years ago.
But it, yeah. and that, right. And then now there seemed to be a standoff for a number of days, but yesterday for sure
mm-hmm.
he was hauled out. And
he was they did a standard perp walk with the guy, I understand.
Right.
Humiliated him.
Right.
And he basically was quoted to somebody saying that he was, you know, in so many words, I know, I'm fucked, you know. So he knew, he could see the future that he was going to be extradited to the United States. They were going to try him. They had the goods on him. And they were going to put him away just like his brother, ex-president, the
right.
guy who benefited from the 2009 coup and thought that he would use that to, you know, solidify himself as a tyrant, as a big strong man, which Latin America has a long, long history of. In fact, the boom writers, the famous boom writers from Marquez to, I can't think of them right now, a lot of them, Peru and, you know, down in the cone, southern cone, all these writers, these famous fictional writers in the 80s and 70s and 80s, they called them the boom writers, a magical realism and things like that. Every one of
uh-huh.
them virtually were obligated to write their tyrant novel. And I have at least, you know, eight or nine of them. I've read some of them. Garcia Marquez wrote one, Autumn of the Patriarch. You know, they all have them. You know, they detail the personal, narcissistic, power-lusting kind of human drama of these people who gravitate to power and become tyrants. You know, in Central America, under the tutelage of the Monroe Doctrine in the United States, is very good at this. I mean, FDR, of course, referred to, Anastasio Somoza Sr., Anastasio Somoza Jr.'s father in Nicaragua, referred to him as FDR, referred to him, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. You know, that's sort of been the theme. And, of course, just to complete the story, Anastasio Somoza Sr. was killed eating dinner at a restaurant in León by a busboy who came up and shot him in the head. And, of course, the busboy was then mowed down with 8,000 rounds. But, He is famous. He is famous in Nicaragua. I forget his name, but the busboy and the thing about that I found about Nicaragua that was just Central America was so amazing was everybody considered themselves a poet. Who was it? Ruben Dario. Ruben Dario was a Nobel Prize-winning poet from Nicaragua in the 20s. And so everybody, you know, I'd send letters in my stumbling Spanish to people I met, and they would always include poetic things on, you know, little poetic remarks. And I was communicating with a woman who was a photographer on, she had this wooden crude box camera, and I sent her a bunch of photo paper in the mail, and she would send me these lofty poems about freedom and dignity and all this stuff, and of course we were cynical as ever, and when we were, you know, so we were opposing, you know, people who were poor but poets and things like that, and anyway, I'm going off, you know.
Well, it's interesting because, I guarantee you 99 out of 100 have not, Kansans have not even ventured, any further than Mexico,
that's why we can get away with this stuff. Maybe
just the resorts. I mean, the people I do know have went is Cancun or something.
Yeah,
that's about
it.
So this news is pretty big, because now wouldn't you say this is different? Is this different than who was that guy under Bush one? Manuel Ortega?
Noriega in Panama.
Yeah,
that
Panama.
Was Panama. See, Panama is a different animal than Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. Nicaragua, even Costa Rica and Panama are quite different. Costa Rica, because it's the premier microclimate, very interesting place in Central America. So that the conquistadors decided Honduras was a, pardon the expression, a shithole, and they decided, well, geez, this Costa Rica area is beautiful, my God. And so they, one reason or another, end up Costa Rica did not have a large indigenous Mayan population, unlike Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, which had a huge, population of Mayan Indians, Native Americans, Central Americans.
Yeah.
We're all Americans in this Western Hemisphere. And so, Panama, of course, was originally, about in 1898 period, or I guess it was before that. I'm trying to get my dates right here. But under Teddy Roosevelt, with all sorts of finagling and rather dishonest politics and backroom backstabbing, stole the Honduran or the Panamanian isthmus, the narrow area there. They stole it, literally stole it from Colombia, the United States did, for the purposes of the canal, of putting the canal through so ships didn't have to go through Cerro del Fuego and down the base of South America to go all the way around to the West Coast. They could cut through that little isthmus. And, of course, at the time, there was tremendous competition with, you know, capitalists and investors and France and states, et cetera, to have the canal go through Nicaragua. In many ways, using Lake Nicaragua and some of the lakes and rivers there, it would have been, you know, a different kind of challenge rather than the isthmus of Panama. But in Panama is where it ended up. You know, they have these locks. These huge ships go into a lock and they fill it up with water because the Pacific and the Atlantic at the same place. You know, the sea level is different, you know, by a number of significant feet, so that, you know, it's a very tricky thing, the Panama Canal, not unlike the Suez Canal is just a ditch, you know, but the Panama Canal is quite a sophisticated operation with locks and things. And then, of course, they've created the canal zone, which became United States sovereign territory. We took it. It's ours. And because we wanted to control the canal strategically. And then, you know, by the 1950s, they had, you know, very sterile, you know, housing developments for, like, you know, Guantanamo on Cuba. They, you know, they were going to stay for the long period, and people who came from the United States to work the canal, you know, were given fine houses, and they had these little communities, sterile communities that were very different from the local sort of villages and things. And so the canal zone, you know, built its own little image until you get to the Carter administration with Omar Torrijos, the famous general who ran Panama at the time. And so the liberation of the canal zone became a big, big, big topic, you know, during the 80s and all this kind of stuff. And then Carter oversaw giving the canal to Panama officially, although the United States, you know, had them by the you-know-whats. And so the canal is now owned by Panama. And, of course, Panama and the Panama Papers and all this is known for incredible corruption and financial money laundering and God knows what else. So it's, you know, it's Panama. It's a different animal than these other, you know, countries that had significant poor Mayan populations, which, of course, in Guatemala and El Salvador were just outright slaughtered at times, you know. Anyway, it's a messy place, you know.
It seemed like in Panama, and we're going back to Manuel Noriega, I guess that's his name, the guy, the thug they arrested. But I remember as a young man in Kansas, and all you hear in Kansas is the extreme conservative right-wing bullshit. It was, and they, I think it was Carter. I think they blamed Carter.
It was worse than that.
Carter,
I mean, in right-wing propaganda, goes, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, that was sort of the common thing. Carter gave away the canal. That was
exactly
a big deal, wasn't it?
Carter stabbed us in the back, and, stabbed in the back, a variant of it. Carter stabbed us in the back because he gave away our wonderful possession of the canal to those goddamn beaners down there in Panama. You know, that was the line, basically.
But here it is. But under, I think it was Reagan or Bush, one.
Right. Yeah.
Here comes, they arrest this fucking general, and I still haven't put it together.
He was an arrogant SOB. Manuel Noriega was an arrogant son of a bitch, a killer, and he was an intelligence officer under Omar Torrijos, who, if we remember, died in a plane crash, like, oops. His plane fell out of the sky, and Manuel Noriega took over. Well, Manuel Noriega had him fucking assassinated by killing him in a plane crash, probably with CIA oversight. Well, George Bush Sr., of course, was the head of the CIA at the time, I believe. You know, remember when George Bush Sr. was, he was a UN ambassador for a while, and then he's, you know, he was the company man for the Republican dynasty that could be plugged in anywhere to fill any position. He was a good soldier and all that.
Yeah.
And so he became the CIA director. Well, Manuel Noriega became too uppity. He decided he's one of these, you know, like Carter himself. He looked at all the, hey, I can swim with these politicians. These, who the hell are these? You know, I can swim with. Noriega decided, hey, these fucking Americans, I'm as good as they are. You know, I'm as smart as they are. They're cynical, power-hungry pricks just like me, you know. And he was the intelligence officer who worked with the CIA. Well, he got too uppity. That's the reason we invaded. He got too uppity. He was involved in drug trafficking, for sure, and that's the deadly thing they get him. And so they then went down and arrested him in a famous standoff for like 5 days where they played, Inagata DeVita, you know, screaming and loud music into his place, these horrible, like, hard rock music and stuff. And, you know, they psychobombed him until he gave up. And then they brought him to the United States. They tried him. And they put him in a prison in Cutler Ridge, near where I was raised in Florida, you know, in this federal prison they cranked up near where I lived. And that's where he ended up dying. That was the end of Manuel Noriega. He thought he could swim with the big boys, right? Well, the big boys showed him no way, baby. You know, you are nothing but a beaner general, and I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, you have to know your place, and so they put him in jail. That's my, that's my particular version.
That's your rough-handed,
It's a little rough, but okay. You get the point. You know?
But yeah, it's okay. It's following the general line because I'm still trying to sort this out but with the Hernandez in Honduras because this is like Manuel Noriega doubled and quadrupled. I mean,
it shares the fact that the pretext of arresting him is drug war related. Yes, that's the key. That's the similarity. You know,
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
I want to add this. I want to for your memory.
Sure.
To prod your memory because unusual as it is now. Listeners, you regular listeners of Radio Free Kansas know that we've added to the program schedule on Saturday nights a show called The Abolitionist Hour, and it's hosted by a guy named Carl G. Now, that's his real name. Carl was in the U.S. Army in Panama.
Okay.
Now, I haven't.
Right.
He hasn't talked to me much about it. But he said that he got put on some sort of guard duty, or he was sort of he was punished. It wasn't major punishment.
Right.
He was punished in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he saw, but the invasion of Panama. I guess.
Yeah.
We went down there and killed a shitload of people.
Well, in order to quote arrest Manuel Noriega, because he was getting too uppity with the big boys in American Empire, you know, he thought he was, hey, you know, I put my pants on just like you guys, you know, what do you think, you know? And Manuel Noriega, much of a thug as he was, a criminal, he was also a pretty smart guy, obviously. I remember waking up in the morning to my alarm clock of George Bush Sr. announcing that he had invaded Panama. I remember the moment, And sure enough, you know, it was an invasion of American military, and obviously the bombings and strafings and killings and destruction of a war, of an invasion, it killed a lot of people. And it shuffled down to a standoff with Manuel Noriega in his palace or whatever the hell it was, and the United States surrounding it. And the ludicrous part was the psycho war kind of stuff of they were, you know, blasting, punk rock and hard steel, hardcore rock, you know, the most obnoxious loud stuff with huge, huge speakers. They were blasting it into the place, you know. I mean, I just remember the absurdity of that. And then he finally, you know, he capitulated and gave up, and they arrested him, and they put him in jail in Cutler Ridge. Cutler Ridge was a big development with a big shopping center, like a lot of places in Florida where, you know, the sea level is just below the ground. You dig 3 feet, you find water down there, right? Everything, all the housing developments are Cutler Ridge, South Miami Heights, you know, and they used all the mountain metaphors for these little areas. And so he was put in a federal prison they constructed in Cutler Ridge, just off from the shopping center, the nearest shopping center to us. But anyway, that's a little sidebar there.
Well, I was just bringing this up because it seemed to be a different time. It seemed to be, more blatant than Honduras. Vice President Harris goes down there at the inauguration.
Panama is a different animal. Panama was considered, certainly by the imperialists in our culture, U.S. sovereign territory. It wasn't like Honduras. Honduras during the Contra War was jokingly called the aircraft carrier Honduras. In other words, Honduras was a punk that we punched around and kicked around and, you know, treated like shit because it was, like in they say in the United States, thank God for Mississippi, at least we're not as bad off as them, you know, in our stats and our numbers of education and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, people in Honduras say, well, God, thank God for Haiti, you know, where they're even worse than we are, you know. But the two H countries, Haiti and Honduras, are the two, traditionally, the two bottom dogs in the Western Hemisphere that certainly were both, you know, kicked around by the United States. There's no other way to describe it. You know, they were poor, pathetic countries with histories of terrible imperial involvement in the United States. And, you know, as I say, Obama didn't have the balls enough to transition above that. He decided, well, hey, what am I, you know, I've got to preserve my power here, so I got to play along and kick Honduras like everybody else does, you know. You know, it's like, yeah, I don't know, you know,
these aren't the right words, but it sounds like there's some goddamn pecking order among dictators. It's like the Panamanians, I guess, are the life around the Panama.
Panama is certainly much more sophisticated than Honduras and Tegucigalpa. Panama City,
Honduras,
you know,
I see. Yeah.
You know, the Panama City with the Panama Papers, you know, is quite a huge, you know, it's a big city with a lot of financial money laundering stuff, corruption and whatnot. And of course, when Omar Torrijos, who's a very, very interesting man, a military man, but, you know, had some enlightened qualities. Obviously, he could be a prick and he was in charge, but he was befriended by the novelist, English novelist, Graham Greene, and I don't know if people know who he was, wrote the Quiet American, the Comedians about Haiti, a number of wonderful novels about, you know, Americans in foreign intrigues. But he, late in his life, he became friends with Omar Torrijos. Graham Greene was a leftist. Omar Torrijos was not a communist, but he was a reformist on the left, a military man. And, of course, the United States decided that he was inconvenient for them. And he, I'm totally convinced, our CIA hooked up with Manuel Noriega, the intelligence officer in Panama under Torrijos.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they killed him in a plane crash. Bingo. It's simple as that. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, come on. It's a clear, I mean, it's considered an assassination. And of course,
out
of that assassination of this quite interesting, you know, not perfect, but reasonably reformist mind and enlightened, you know, despot as he was, a military man, Omar Torrijos was a quite interesting fellow. He was just too interesting, and, you know, the thugs did him in, you know, the lined up with the CIA. And, of course, the CIA is just fine get rid of Omar Torrijos because he's inconvenient. You know, he's in bed with Graham Greene, this leftist novelist, and he's doing this, he's doing that. You know, he's getting a lot of news. And so they went with, as they usually do, they went with the thugs, you know, because the thugs, they thought, just Manuel Noriega, you know, this guy down in this place, you know, he's a Central American. He's not a sophisticated American. He didn't go to Yale and all that, you know. And so they think they can control this guy. Well, this guy eventually has to deal with people like George Bush and company and the CIA and all these. And he realizes, like, wait a minute. These guys are slug fucks just like me, you know? And who do they think they are? You know, they think they're better than us because, you know, they're richer, but they're just as corrupt and loathsome as I am. So, hey, I can look them in the eye and be, you know, one of the boys. And they decided, no, no way, baby, no way. And so, you know, we invaded the place. And arrested him and
well, now they didn't do,
put him in jail in Coleridge.
You're also somehow to help with the Kansas version of this.
Right, of course.
So maybe if we take one more leap here.
Okay.
If we went from the former president of Honduras being arrested by, now the Americans didn't arrest him. It was actually the Honduran police and the military.
Hernandez, well, of course.
Arresting.
Right. We don't do invasions anymore.
We go to Panama because. But let me finish. So we go to, but we invade Panama under Bush 1.
Right.
Literally with U.S. troops and helicopters and all kinds of shit. I think
the bombings, strafing.
Estimated about 3,000 people were killed, I believe, Panamanians. I think maybe more. Okay, and that was because they got a general they couldn't control, and it was making drug money. But here in between Manuel Noriega and President Hernandez, former President Hernandez of Panama, we have Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Now
they cooed him in 2002 as well. You know, he was cooed out, and, of course, it lasted several days, and he beat them. He came back. You know,
this is what I'm trying to explain. This is what I'm connecting dots about.
Right, of course.
These dictators, because today, the legacy of Hugo Chavez is shit among the people in the D.C. elite, whatever, State Department, whoever you want to talk to. You know,
of course.
The government. That's really weird.
Why is that weird? I mean, that goes along with the standard response, you know? Anybody who's a leftist down there suddenly gets the treatment. And, you know, now I'll say this for Hugo Chavez. You know, I traveled to Venezuela in 2006, I think it was. I was on his Sunday TV show. You know, it went on for 8 hours. He sat there like Johnny Carson Jay Leno at a little table. Place was full of writers from Africa, diplomats, gringo John Grant and his pal Ron. And, you know, we were there and he talked to us. He pointed us out in his 8 hours of, you know, in his TV show called Allo Presidente every Sunday. And it would be broadcast all around the country. And, you know, I said my piece that I was here in solidarity with the people of Venezuela. And, you know, he came over and he shook our hands and he talked to us. I was a gringo periodista, you know. And so, you know, at the time, I really admired Hugo Chavez because his coup, I mean, Hugo Chavez was a fearless individual. That was the one thing. And the guy was just fearless. And he had the gift of a caudillo, which is, of course, a Latin American tradition, tyrants. And he, unfortunately, as I look back, he was not enough of a statesman. He was more of a tyrant. He was a caudillo. He was a classic Latin American caudillo in that sense. And alas, I think he was not in the end. I don't think he was good for Venezuela. I think the better example is the guy, I forget his name, he was the president of Ecuador for quite a while, the guy who threw out the huge U.S. base in Ecuador before he, you know, his term was up. And he was, you know, a U.S.-trained economist, and he was a sophisticated statesman. But he didn't do the things like, you know, Hugo did. And I think Hugo, to be perfectly honest and fair, I think Hugo was in the end, although I was wrong and many people were wrong, not good for Venezuela. He should have been more of a statesman and done something different. But that's, hey, that's water over the dam. What are you going to do, you know?
Yeah.
But,
well,
you know,
I'm just using this as a rough history for people
who are
caught off guard by this thing of the arrest and extradition of the former president of Honduras back to the United States with his brother to serve.
Right. But to me, these classic coups, the 2009 coup was probably one of the last in Central America that'll go along with the Guatemala 54 sort of modus operandi. That nowadays things are much different because of the iPhones and everything, information, that it's hard to pull off these things, you know, so that for some reason, good reason, it totally surprised me. I dropped the ball and wasn't really paying attention to Honduras when Xiomara Castro was elected. It came out of nowhere for me because, again, I wasn't paying attention. But what seems to have happened is there seems to have been a rather serious shift, earth change here or whatever, that was fed up with the corruption of the, let's call it the coup government, you know, which led to Hernandez and his, you know, tyranny and, you know, gangster government that he had set up with his brother and, of course, other many, many other people. And that for one reason or other, all good reasons, that it there seems to have been a sea change, and this Xiomara Castro was elected, again, significantly. They don't play it up much, but she's the wife of Zelaya. And out of that is the obvious criminal nature of Hernandez. It was like his brother's already in jail. And so, I mean, they had the goods on the guy. It's just a matter of applying them and having the will to apply them. And somehow the election, the sea change that led to Castro's election somehow was his downfall, his doom, and he was arrested. So it all seems, in retrospect, kind of natural to me that happened. And that this sea change in Honduras is actually a good sign. I'm delighted with her election. Now, it's a pretty nasty, corrupt business to be president of Honduras, let me tell you. At least that's my estimation. So, you know, I wish her well, and let's hope it doesn't get corrupted and whatnot. But It's a nasty business, especially being the one of the poorest nations in the hemisphere, mercy of the most powerful nation in the world. Poor Honduras, poor Honduras, the ditch, is, you know, I really
well, it's
feel
supposed to be
place.
Vice,
online
Vice magazine online.
Yeah.
Breaking article just a few days, about a week ago, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And
good.
Or, well, I don't know. It was very recent about this guy and his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the allegations are that they are responsible. Now, they didn't bring in, they just allowed the transit of like mm-hmm. 500 tons. That was the number, 500 tons of cocaine over the years.
Right, of course.
Across the country. And I guess it was Colombian cartels. There's all kinds of people involved in this.
Well, the drug war has been building in sophistication for, what, 30 years now at least? Every time they up the antes on the drug war side, you know, they up the antes on the other side. You know, they have submarines. They have all kinds of things. You know, this is... The drug war, like the Prohibition in the 20s, which created mobsters and instead of corporations making the booze, you know, killers and mobsters started making the booze, you know. And so the same dynamic is at work, you know, incredibly in the drug war, and same as the Prohibition in the 20s and 30s. And so we created, because of our drug war nonsense, these people, the criminal element down there linked with the government. And, of course, if you have the weakest link, the poorest link in Latin America, and it's parked right there in Central America with a coastline on the Caribbean, a very big coastline on the Caribbean in the Atlantic, this is a perfect, ideal jumping-off point for, you know, drugs from Colombia and places like that into the United States. It's just crying out for development as a drug war launching, you know, point. Really, I'm not kidding, literally. And
the words, it's crying out for development. You act like it's just... Real
well,
estate.
I'm being ironic, of course. Right. It's on which, whose ox is gored here, you know? It's whose side you're on. You know?
Right. And what was that place? That you said the place you grew up in Florida has become a federal prison. What was that, like Cutlass or something? What was it?
Oh, well, Cutler Ridge, yeah. Well, of course, we were surrounded by it.
Cutler,
we had Chrome Avenue a couple miles away from us, which is where they put Haitians and whatnot, refugees that wash up on our shores, and they were abused in Chrome Avenue Detention Center, not far from where I lived. And on the other side, US 1, was Cutler Ridge, where they have a federal prison, and where they ensconced Manuel Noriega until he died. I guess he died about 10 years ago. Yeah. And, of course, we had Homestead Air Force Base, Strategic Air Command, on the other side, south of us, and we could hear the B-52s warming up, you know, and that's where my dad would... They had a huge poster, a huge billboard out front that said... Strategic Air Command, Homestead Air Force Base, peace is our profession. And my cynical old bigoted PhD dad, World War II vet, would go by that and scoff. Oh, that's such bullshit, you know, peace is our profession. He knows that they got B-52 bombers. No. You know, as much as a warmonger my old man was, he knew hypocrisy when he saw it. You know? Wait a minute, peace is our... That's why Stanley Kubrick, when he has Dr. Strangelove, and the Army is about to take... You're attacking General Jack Ripper's Air Force Base. You know, he started World War III. And you know, there also is very authentic combat footage. You know, they're shooting, and it's like a moving camera, and they're shooting all around the same big billboard that says the irony. You know,
right.
Kubrick, a comedian, he loves the irony. Peace is our profession. They're shooting the place
up. Right. Shooting each other.
One of the great films we should all revisit, Dr. Strangelove, periodically, just to get the
That's
wisdom.
That's right. That is absolutely.
And
to
of
be
course,
every
I might finally say that because of 7 Days in May, or one of those other movies that Sidney Lumet was making. They were making the two bomb movies at the same time, and Kubrick decided, well, shit, we're going up against Sidney Lumet's film. They hooked up with Terry Southern, who wrote Candy back in those days, and they made it into a comedy. It was not intended as a comedy. It was intended to be straight.
Strange Love was not supposed to be a comedy. I didn't
know. No, it was supposed to. They may have had a different name to it. I don't know.
There were a few. And I don't know exactly what year there was. Fail Safe and then 7 Days in
Fail
May.
Safe, that was the
several
other
of them, I think.
Fail Safe with the Sidney Lumet film, and it was played serious.
Okay.
Now, how many people consider
Fail
Safe a classic? Well, Stanley Kubrick was brilliant. He decided, look, we can't go head-to-head with two movies on the same theme, both dead serious. And so they completely reworked the thing into the gem that it is, a comedy.
And Peter Sellers enabled, who played multiple characters in that.
Oh, he did.
He was
Dr. Strangelove, he's the President of the United States, and he's Colonel Mandrake, the Canadian officer who deals with Jack Ripper. You know, Sterling Hayden's my favorite role. I want to have the movie, the movie as a midnight show like they used to have with that, the movie where everybody played these cross-dresser parts and everything, at night, crazy stuff.
Rocky Horror Show. Rocky Horror Show.
I want for adults, I want a midnight showing of Dr. Strangelove, and I want to be...
I want to be
General Jack Ripper.
Jack
Ripper. And, the exchanges with Mandrake, and he says to Mandrake,
I like Mandrake.
Mandrake's great. Jack says, well, Mandrake, I'm really worried that when they capture me, they're not going to be happy. They're going to be hard on me. And Mandrake says, Jack, I think you may be right, And so he says, Mandrake, have you ever been tortured? He says, oh, yeah, those goddamn Japanese, they were good at it. And then he says, but they make such great radios, And then Jack says, Mandrake, I'm afraid that when they capture me, they'll torture me, and I don't know how I'll hold up under torture. And Mandrake says, yeah, Jack, they may be hard on you, And at that point, Jack goes into the bathroom and shoots himself in the head.
Shoots himself in the head.
To avoid torture, And it's the most brilliant movie that's ever been made, I think.
What I remember of Sellers' character Mandrake is that he was watching the general go crazy.
Of course,
I think he was sort of knocked off guard about it. As like,
the general had told him to impound all radios because he knew, the radios would. He's starting this. There is no real invasion.
Yeah, he started it.
It's a fiction. It's like a current fiction of the election being stolen,
He gave
and,
him the code to launch the bombs.
He launched the bombs, absolutely. And it's of course, Slim Pickens' plane that finally gets through and ends the world, And So anyway, he impounded the radios, and they're closing up at night, and Mandrake finds this little transistor radio, which he says, the Japanese are so good at making these think. And he finds it, and it's playing music. And he's going, Jack, look, if we're under an invasion, why are they playing music, you know? And
Why is there music?
Yeah, right. Why is the plane even, why aren't they playing music? Oh, just brilliant, just brilliant. Anyway.
I don't know. Well, we can't blame nuclear war on Honduras. We cannot blame nuclear war on Honduras, but
yeah, well,
we
never got
Ukraine.
To Ukraine, of course. Yeah, right.
Ukraine.
By the way,
I joke, listeners, you've been listening to John Grant, and I told John at the show, I said, well, you never know, we might both be dead by the end of the show with Ukraine.
Well, I just want everybody to know that today is 2-2-2-2-2, and this is the day, the anniversary 7 years ago, that Yanukovych was run out in Ukraine. Very interesting date. 2-2-2-2-2.